Thank you so much. My background is as a school teacher in high school. And so when I'm up there way far away from people, like, I just feel disconnected. And it's, you know, I like to feel close and be able to see your faces and all of that sort of thing. So turn over to John chapter 14. And we're just going to kind of pick up where we left off here in the last session. As I said, in the first session, I kind of want to lay the foundation for who we are. And we could have gone into much more detail on that. And in fact, if you want, I've already talked with Werner a little bit, but we can figure out something. We have this series of books called the Core series of books that I've written and that we use in the States, and there will eventually be 12 of them. Seven are finished right now, and the eighth one is coming out, but the fourth one is really an expanded version of this topic that we're talking about today. It's called Life as God's Family. And each book is split into seven chapters, and then at the end of every chapter, it has all sorts of resources, so you can use it however you want. There's an individual review and study. There is a small group discussion questions. There's a Bible talk lesson, and there's a classroom lesson plan for every single chapter. And we sell those books at just a little bit of a cost in the U.S. So that we can give them away in Africa. I don't sell books in Africa. So, but it is a little challenging to ship them over here because we're kind of limited by how much we bring in or how much people donate to bring in. So we've sent a number already, but they didn't kind of make their way to Cape Town, not in too many numbers. But what I've talked with Werner's, for those who want, we can figure out how to get you the digital, the PDF version. And it doesn't have the covers on it, but it has everything else, so all the pages. And so we'll make those available to you guys either through Flash Stick or something. We'll figure it out. But those will be available and you can and study further. And really all of the books, not just the fourth one, but we'll make all of those available digitally. So, but they are, it's difficult to print them and ship them. We literally had to put them on a ship and ship them over, and that's still cheaper than if we printed them here. So I think digital is the way to go. And that's just because there's a disciple in the U.S. that runs a printing business, and he lets us print them at cost. So we can print these full 270-page books. They're 8.5 by 11, the big size. Sorry, that was in inches, but and full color, and he prints them for like under $3 a book. So it's awesome. But so we'll pick up in John 14. I'm going to read this and then I'm going to ask you a question. Do not let your hearts be troubled. Verse 1, you believe in God, believe also in me. My Father's house has many rooms. If that were not so, I would have told you that I am going. I'm sorry, if that were not so, would I have told you that I'm going there to prepare a place for you? And if I go to prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you may also be where I am. You know the way to the place where I am going. Now, in a word or two, what is Jesus talking about in this passage?
Marriage.
Marriage, okay. What else? Any other guesses?
We normally believe is that one day we're going to
heaven, right? Okay. And it sounds like either you've studied this out a little bit or the church is taught on it here, but this is a place where I want to start, because most people would say, well, that's about heaven. But the word's not in there. We just sort of look at the context and assume that's what it is. But I think what's actually going on here is, I think you're exactly right. I think Jesus is referring to a marriage custom in the first century, where the young man would see the young lady and he would go, wow, I like her. Let's have the families work this out, or however they did it. And they would become betrothed. And quite typically and traditionally, the father would then say, okay, now you're betrothed, you're officially married, but you haven't consummated the marriage. And the son would then go back to the father's household compound, and he would begin to build a new house or room into this compound. And the father would be the judge. The son didn't know the day or the hour, but the father would be the judge of when it was ready. And when the room was ready, he would come to the son and he would say, okay, it's time. Let the marriage festivities begin. Go get your bride. And he would go get his bride. They would do the marriage party and all of that sort of thing. And then they would go back to this room that they had built that would be their new house now as part of this household compound. And they would, they would consummate the marriage, and the wife would now join that family. She would leave her old family that she was born into and join this new family. And I believe this is the custom that Jesus is talking about. He's not talking about, because think about it, that's not all that comforting to his disciples to say, by the way, I'm about to go to the cross and die, but take heart, because one day in the future, you will go to heaven. He's comforting them then and there, and he's saying, take heart, because yes, I'm going to be gone. I'm leaving, but you know what I'm going to do. I'm going to make you part of the family. This is what I'm doing. You are going to be, I'm building you a room in the Father's household. That's a way of saying you're going to be part of the family. So he's appealing to a custom. I believe that's what he's doing there. I think that makes a lot more sense with the context than, now that's not to say, you mean there's no heaven? I'm not saying that. Of course there's heaven. It just doesn't mean that's not necessarily directly what he's talking about there, right? It's kind of like those old things, you know, what was that passage in Philemon 6 we used to use where he talks about sharing your faith, and we would say, that's an evangelism passage, and then we realized, oh, that's not actually an evangelism passage. It's talking about sharing life together in the faith that we live, but it doesn't mean there's not many other passages that talk about evangelism. Do you know what I'm talking about? Do you remember that verse, right? Okay? Is that, am I, like, ruining everybody's view of Philemon? Okay. Okay, so he's talking about family. So if we are family, and it will take time, I think, to wrap that idea around, because it's so becomes so ingrained in us that Christianity is a privatized personal religion at its core. That's what it is. It's about me and God. But if we really go back and look at the scriptures, like 1 Corinthians 12 says we're baptized into what? The body, right? And sometimes we will even have, let me see if I can find it here. We will have these, this, remember this one, right? Now that's not incorrect, but it's kind of incomplete to the point where if that's our sole picture of conversion, that I die, I'm buried with Christ and I'm raised to a new life. But really, I think a better picture is this. I'm dying to self, I'm entering into Christ, and I'm becoming part of his body. That is what I'm entering into. So it takes the focus off of me. So I want to talk really quickly here about our identity as a family and what that's going to lead us, the way to live. Because we were talking about this with some of the brothers yesterday. We had an amazing time with some of the brothers. It was, if you weren't there, sorry, but it was kind of a small group, and we just had some discussion. We talked about everything in the world, about the kingdom and just all kinds of stuff, and it was one of the most fun things I've done in a long, long time. But we got talking about the early Christian view of the beautiful life, and for them, the number one tool of evangelism was the early, and by them I mean the early Christians, the first couple centuries, was not doctrine. Oh, you believe the right things and now you're a Christian. It was not, you know, come attend church on Sunday. And if you come to church every Sunday and you agree to let us baptize you, then you're in. That wasn't their concept. Evangelism wasn't about, hey, here's a card, come on out. None of those things are bad necessarily if used in the right way. For them, being a Christian was the beautiful life. And it's maybe most succinctly captured in the Sermon on the Mount. That's what it looks like. Loving your enemies. All of those sorts of things captured in the Sermon on the Mount. In fact, a Christian in the first three centuries, if you were to ask today, what is a Christian? We'd probably give some theological explanation of somebody who's accepted this doctrine and that doctrine and attends church and this and that. They would give a very simple definition. Well, it's somebody who lives by the Sermon on the Mount. It's a community of people living by the Sermon on the Mount. That for them was Christianity. And so they said the biggest evangelism tool they had was the community of God living that beautiful life. Not by the world's definitions, not rich, prosperous, those sorts of things, but this beautiful, very otherworldly life that made no sense to the people around you. That loving your enemies sort of life that we talked about yesterday, that's foolish from the world's perspective. Because it doesn't get you ahead, but it does display the kingdom. Right? It's willing to take suffering on. It's willing to be wronged or ripped off or whatever. And not in weakness, but to show you that there's a different way to live. And so because of that, though, they had very high standards. They said the biggest problem then, if the biggest source of evangelism is the community living this beautiful life, then the biggest problem is somebody saying they're part of the community but not living that beautiful life. That was a huge problem. And so they went to painstaking efforts to teach people what it looked like to live out these things in everyday life, to have trust and patience with God, to love one another, these sorts of things. So the first element of the Christian family was love. John 13, you know this, right? We know this verse. I don't think you can be part of the International Churches of Christ if you don't know this verse. We'll boot you out. No. Verse 34, a new command I give you, love one another as I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples if you love one another. I was reading a book recently, and it was a book from a more secular perspective on why Christianity grew in the early centuries. And its point was there were rational, logical reasons why Christianity grew. And one of the main ones, they said, is Christianity grew not because there was some miracle going on from their perspective. They said one of the main components of why Christianity grew was because there were a series of epidemics in the Roman Empire in the first several centuries of Christianity that greatly increased the percentage of Christians. Because it killed off so many Romans and so many Christians lived. And so as the population of Romans decreased from these epidemics and the Christian population didn't decrease as much, a much higher percentage of the Roman Empire was Christians. And then that allowed them to tip the scales and become bigger and bigger in evangelism. And then because of these epidemics, many people lost their trust in the Roman gods and they came over to Christianity. So therefore, they said, without these epidemics, Christianity would have never grown in the way it did. And while I appreciate the effort, I believe they've missed the point. Because what's so stunning to me there is the early Christians, they taught a lot, but they taught very simple concepts. And this was one of the central ones, is love one another. This is what God's family looked like. Now, we know this language. I know you know this. Anybody who's a disciple knows, hey, we're supposed to love one another. But they really hammered home, what does that mean for the family? What does that look like on Monday and Tuesday and at work and in your home and here and at 2 o'clock in the morning when someone calls, they taught through. And if you were not loving one another, then please don't say you're part of us. And they always had, I think, a very liberal open door policy. The standards of what it means to be part of us is up here. And if you don't want to do that, that's fine. The door's that way. But don't go tell people that you're a follower of Christ if you're not going to follow him and live like him. Just don't do it. Because notice Jesus says, what? You must love one another as I have loved you. So they taught them what it meant to love one another. You can't teach everything in life to Christians. I can't teach you, well, when this situation happens, here's what you do. And if an epidemic comes, here's what you do. And if an alien invasion comes, here's what you do. And, you know, when the zombie apocalypse comes, here's what you can't teach through all the possibilities. So what they did is they taught several concepts very simply, very deeply. Here's what it means to love one another. Here's what it means to be patient and trust God. And when the epidemic hit, the pagans scattered. They left the big cities. They didn't want to be around each other because, you know, you're contagious. And the Christians said, whoa, wait a minute. We're called to love one another. There is no calling in the scripture to protect my own life at all costs. You see that? They'd been so trained in reflexive thinking of loving one another as a sign of God's family, not protecting my own life. In fact, I signed up to die. Jesus kept saying, everywhere you turn, you know, by the way, if you follow me, it's going to end in your death. Pick up your cross, you know, it's there. Love one another. So they said, well, what would that look like? I better go to my brother's and sister's house and see if they're okay. We'll take care of them. You're not feeling well? I'm going to stay here and nurse you back to health. The pagans did not do that. And so in these epidemics, they estimate that the pagan survival rate was about 25%. The Christian survival rate, they estimate, was about 80%. You see what I'm saying? So, did the church prosper because of the epidemic? Arguably, yes, but it was because they loved one another. And that's what happens when you love one another. Things in life will happen, but when you're trained to love one another, you will face those waves. And the waves will come. And so they grew, and they even took care of the pagans. And so many pagans turned around and said, okay, we're gonna join this movement. This is real. From loving one another. And in fact, there's one moment in the mid-third century, North Africa, a leader named Cyprian, the church that he led in Carthage had gone through a terrible persecution. And many of the Christians had been imprisoned, killed, what have you. And just a couple years after that, a epidemic breaks out. And we actually have some of the words of Cyprian. He went and addressed, wrote his church, and he said, listen, and I'm going to paraphrase here, but he said, I know they have persecuted you. I know they have killed us, but we will stay in care for these people. We will love them. And many of us will die, but we will love them because this is what we're called to do. This is what it looks like to love your enemies. And that resulted in one of the largest times of conversion in the early church, because so many pagans saw that and thought, that's not normal. But they were prepared to love one another. Does that make sense? That's challenging, but you have to have the family of God as your identity, as your understanding, as your loyalty. This is my family, to really grasp the full concept of that love. We reduce that concept of love. Well, I'm a nice person. I help people out when they need to be. But to really get to that level of love takes training, right? And as Jeremiah 12:5 says, it's one of my favorite passages. It says, how can you run with horses if men wear you out? In other words, how are you going to love in epidemics, in the big moments, if you can't love day to day? If you can't love your brother day to day. So love was a big element. Number two, and we're just going to hit a few of these. There's, you know, there's a few more, but some of the pillar ones. Number two, they shared their resources. I talked about the example of the pizza and, you know, that it's all ours, right? And you see that in the early church. I don't need to read those passages. One, Greg did a great job in the communion going into Acts 2:42. Read that. Does that look like a religion in the first century? No. What does it look like? That looks like a family. They were living as a family. They were sharing their identity, sharing their resources. That said something to the world. And it's interesting, if you read Acts 2 and you read Acts 4, there were Jews taking their land and selling it. Now, if you read the Old Testament, you find out that that was inheritance land. It was their identity as a member of the Jewish nation, the children of Israel. They were selling that land off and taking the resources from it and sharing with the family, with those in need. What a powerful sort of symbol, almost intentionally, that we have switched families. We have switched identities, and we will take care of anyone who is in need. And again, the early Christians saw this as a sign of the beautiful life. How can we go tell people about the age to come? A time where God will deal with evil, and there will be no lack, there will be no poverty, there will be none of those things. How can we go tell the world about that if there is lack and poverty in God's family? And their primary focus was not to go out and help the poor, although they did do some of that. Their main thing was, we have to set up a society, an alternate society, where no one in this family lacks. That's why you keep seeing this about the widow's fund in the New Testament. It was a central part of life. Notice that's like the first controversy that comes up. Acts 6 is, hey, some of the widows are being neglected, and how can we be who we say we're going to be if there's people in our community that are lacking? So they were very creative about that. We've got to make sure that we are figuring out how to do that. And in fact, at times, there was one Roman emperor in the second century who basically, I'm paraphrasing again, but he basically said, I can't stand those Christians, but my, how they love one another. And at times they would be like, listen, they love our poor better than we love our poor. And there was one incident even where one of the emperors had kicked out all the Christians from this particular, not an emperor, one of the governors had kicked out all the Christians from his town. He's like, I'm done with you. All Christians got to go. And the poor folks in the town rioted and said, you better let those Christians back in. Now, that's awesome, but I wonder, if we were kicked out, would anyone even notice? So they shared their resources. And Paul talks about that in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9. He says this is becoming a community built on the manna principle, where there's no surplus, there's no lack, there's sufficiency. And the early church talked about that a lot. In fact, they said it's monstrous for a Christian to have way more than they need and live in luxury while there are brothers and sisters who have nothing. And I think the challenge that you see the first century church taking up that we have to always keep in mind is this family is not just here in Cape Town. It's a global family. It's brothers and sisters in Malawi and in India and Burundi and Rwanda and wherever. Are we taking care of one another? But it was that beautiful life. Now, as I said, and I'm going to tread lightly here, so try to understand what I'm saying. They didn't emphasize evangelism, as we would call it. I'm not saying don't go evangelize, don't invite people, don't reach out. I'm not saying that. But they didn't really have to emphasize that, because they emphasized this beautiful life. If we be the church, if we go out and live this way, God will raise up the opportunities where our light will shine. People will see it. Now, don't sit there and use that as an excuse to, well, now I don't have to share my faith anymore. That's not what I'm saying. But you go back to the early centuries, there were no sort of master evangelism plans to canvass the world in this. It spread as they went. And they set up these alternate societies, and they lived so differently that people took notice. And one of the realities of this is we in the 21st century have a tendency when we're making an apology, as it would be, apologetics is sort of explaining Christianity. So when I say making an apology, I don't mean in the sense of we're sorry, but in the sense of defending your community or your faith. When we make an apology for the Christian community, it tends to go something like this. You know, we're cool too. I mean, we're fun. We're just like the world. We have awesome music. We have awesome community. We have awesome events. We're normal. The problem with that is then, why come? If you're basically just like the world, why bother? If the best thing a church has going for them, and I know this isn't you guys, and I'm not saying, you know, just have lousy music, but I'm saying if the best thing you have going for you is your concert on Sunday mornings, I'm sorry, but there are better ones. I can go catch Paul McCartney or something. I can go catch Imagine Dragons. I like Imagine Dragons. I only know about four of their songs, but I like all of them. The early Christians were actually counterintuitive. They constantly trumpeted not how they were like the world, but how different they were. They didn't say, hey, we're like this, we're relevant, we're cool. They were like, we're not cool. We're not like you. We don't take part in the same entertainment you do. We don't live the way you do. We don't take part in your politics. We don't believe in the state and those sorts of things. We're vastly different. We take care of our poor. We love folks. You think it's okay to take your children, and if you don't want them, lay them out on the street to let them die. It was a normal Roman practice called exposure. But the early church didn't say, we've got to get politicians in place and pass laws. They didn't actually, in that sense, want to force the world to live the kingdom way. They just grabbed these children up and said, we'll raise them. See how different we are? Come join our community. They knew that laws were not the way to change the world. That doesn't get you any closer to the kingdom. We'll live differently. And I don't know what that looks like in a first century context, and I don't want to get too involved in you know, specific issues, but I wonder, you know, I've seen some groups, and I really appreciate what they do, and I'm not criticizing others, but like, for instance, you know, abortion is a big thing, especially in the United States, and trying to pass laws and things. But there are groups raising up now that says, you know what, instead of doing that, if you're a young mother and you don't feel like you can have this baby, we will pay you well to have this baby, and we'll take and care for this baby. Just let us have the baby, that's all. No strings attached. That's, I think, a little closer to how the early Christians would have thought. So, it's a beautiful life. Then in Philippians chapter 2, I'm just going to quickly hit this one. In fact, I'm going to assume I'm going to make an assumption here that you know this passage well. Right? In Greek. Mariner's going to stand up and recite this passage in Greek and Aramaic just in case. Now, we know this passage well, right? Put the interests of one another first. But I don't know if you know how countercultural this passage really was. Because in a nutshell, in the Roman culture, which Philippi was well known to be like the most Roman city outside of Rome, Philippi was very proud of that. And Paul comes in and preaches this massively countercultural gospel. Because in the Roman culture, you did everything you could to get ahead. You wanted to be praised and honored in the eyes of others. Life was about getting ahead. And there was 2% of the population was elite, 98% was considered non-elite, but there were levels of status in each of those two categories, and you wanted people to praise you. You took advantage of every opportunity you could. Humility was considered a weakness and a vice. Nobody would be humble. Who would do that? You would praise yourself. You would make sure that people knew how great you were. If you were speaking in front of a crowd, you would expect the speaker to spend several minutes at the beginning telling you how great they were, so that you could know. Obedience was considered something of lower classes. Freedom was what important people had. Freedom and pride, boasting, getting ahead. Low class people had obedience and humility and had to think about the interests of others. So Paul flips this on his head and says, that's what Jesus was. Jesus was the highest imaginable human being who intentionally lowered himself and suffered and sacrificed for the benefit of you. And I think this was so powerful to them, not only because this was the example of Jesus, but because the people in Philippi, when they got this letter, they had already seen Jesus do this. Now, hopefully you go, wait a minute, that doesn't seem right. How would converts in Philippi have seen Jesus sacrifice for the benefit of others? They weren't there in Jerusalem. Well, they were not. But in Acts 16, we are told of a time when Paul comes in and he preaches the gospel in Philippi, and he and Silas are arrested, and they're thrown in jail, and they are beaten. Spend a night in jail, and then they're released. And on the way out, Paul says what? Oh, by the way, I'm a Roman citizen. That's a problem, because if you beat a Roman citizen without a trial, you can now be put to death. But my question has always been, why did Paul wait until after the beating to say that he was a Roman citizen? That seems like information that would have been good to know a few hours ago. I don't think he forgot, but I think what happened is the heat was coming down on this new church, these young converts, persecution is coming its way, and Paul says, yeah, I could pull out my Roman citizenship, my trump card, and leave, but imagine what a hypocrite he would look like if he said, the gospel is about sacrificing for the benefit of others and laying down your advantages, but don't touch me because I'm a Roman citizen. And he leaves, and the heat now turns around on you, the young church. So instead, Paul stands up and says, go ahead. And they know that Paul is a Roman citizen. They know that Paul is taking this. We don't even need it. That's fine. Yeah, thank you. They know that Paul is taking this beating for their benefit. See, this looks familiar, Philippians 2, because Paul's already lived it out in front of them. They've seen the echo of Christ in their own community. They've seen it. And so it's this sacrificing for the benefit of others that was a hallmark of the family of God. We've got to move on for sake of time. Just do one more. Is the forgiveness of the family, grace and forgiveness. In 2 Peter 3:18, it speaks of growing in grace. continuing to have that kind of mark. And they, again, the Christians were known for this. And it was part of the way they loved one another as family. In fact, there is a writer in the second century named Lucian of Samosata. And he was a critic of the early Christians. And he puts forth two main criticisms of the Christians, why you would not want to be around that group of people. And you ready for this? Because I want you to imagine if there was a big expose in the biggest newspaper in Cape Town or South Africa about the church here. And these were the two criticisms of the Cape Town Church of Christ. Are you ready? Number one, he said, these fools despise death because they actually believe they will be resurrected. What a bunch of morons. And number two, these idiots believe that they are actually brothers and sisters of one another. And they live that way. And they love each other and show grace and forgiveness and those sorts of things. What fools. In fact, in 1 Corinthians 6, this is why Paul says, this is the reason in that culture, Paul says, you cannot be taking one another to court. Because in the first century, you resolved everything legal-wise through legal means, through the courts. You sued other people, and that's how you got recompense and so on. But the one, culturally, the one group that you would not take to court was your family. You would let yourself be ripped off by your family. And so Paul says, if you as Christians are taking each other to court, you are telling the world that you're not really family after all. That was the problem with that. He said, you can't send that signal to the world. Now, that does not mean that now blindly we can't go to court, although I find it hard to imagine a scenario in which it would be healthy for a member of the Christian family to take another member to court. But I think that means we have to think through, are there ways that we send signals to the world that we're not really family, we just say it. He said, you can't do that. You've got to be grace, truth, and love. Matthew 18, verse 21 to 35, I won't take the time to read it now, but Jesus tells a parable. I think you'll know it well when I start describing it. And he talks about a servant who has a huge, massive, unpayable debt. It's billions of dollars. And the master forgives him, and he turns around and he goes to a fellow servant who just owes him a few bucks, and he starts to strangle him. And Jesus' point is, if you do not forgive, even though you have been forgiven much, then you do not understand what it means to be part of this family. You don't understand. You're demonstrating that you're not living by the values of your father, and that's what you do in the ancient world. You, if you're part of the family, your values are your father's values. Sometimes, you know, we will hurt each other in the body of Christ, and sometimes we feel like, well, that shouldn't happen in the church. Shouldn't happen in the church. Like, somebody hurt me, or they, you know, this or that, or they let me down, or they sinned against me. But think about how many times in the New Testament it will say things like Colossians 3, where it says, forgive one another, be patient with one another, bear with one another. The fact that it says that is a promise that you will have a reason to. You'll have a reason to forgive and be patient and bear with one another. It will happen. It's a promise. So the next time another Christian hurts you, instead of getting all indignant and upset, you should fall down on your knees and say, thank you, God, another prophecy answered. Prophecy fulfilled. It said I was going to be hurt and have to forgive, and here we are. God is God. It's absolute. See, I'm convinced of this. God would not be brought glory if we were all perfect. Why would that bring God glory? Any group of people could be loyal to one another if they're all perfect. But what the world does is, as soon as you're no good to me anymore, as soon as you hurt me, as soon as, you know, you don't meet my standard, and I see that on social media all the time. You got to cut ties with all the people who drag you down and aren't good for you and hurt you. That's the world's thinking. As soon as you're not what I want you to be, I'm out of here. But the Bible message is, yeah, we'll let each other down. We'll blow it. And we're all trying to move in the direction of Christ. But we stay loyal because we're part of a family, not because we all deserve it. And I think we can make that mistake sometimes where, I mean, it's good to trumpet the good things about your church and why you're different. Hey, we're multiracial and this and that. But I think that can go too far. And I think we did that maybe sometimes in the past where we start to go, oh man, our marriages are awesome and our families are all awesome and we never have divorces and we figure it all out and our kids are perfect and we love each other and it's amazing and come and people come for the first few Sundays and they're like, wow, it really is amazing. This is awesome. I want to be part of it. And then they come around and then after a few months, they're like, oh, there's flaws here. And now I'm disillusioned. And you're not perfect. I don't give that mirage. I tell people, you know what, man, our church is not perfect. We're working on stuff. We have a long way to go. We mess stuff up, man. People drive me crazy. I drive them crazy. We let each other down. We fail, but we are God's family. And if nothing else, we're loyal. And we forgive one another and we move on. And I just want to end with this story to give us a picture of what forgiveness in the family can really look like, the power of it. And then we'll be done. John tells us in John 18 that it's a cold night. It's a Cape Town kind of night in August when Jesus is being taken to the cross. And we know that because Peter is standing around and John uses a very specific word. He says in the Greek, it's an anthrakia, which translates roughly to a coal fire. And Peter's standing around and somebody says, hey, you're with him, aren't you? And he says, I don't know him. And someone else says, no, I think you're with him. And he says, in essence, I swear to God, I don't know him. And a third time, are you sure you're not the guy? I think you're one of those Galileans. May God curse me, I swear to God, I don't know him. And the thing about an anthrakia, you ever had a smell like something, and then you smell that smell, and it immediately, like these memories rush in that you associate with that smell. Scientists actually say that the sense of smell is one of the strongest triggers of the memory banks. To this day, if I smell a wood-burning fire, I'm taken back to my grandma and grandpa's house in northern Wisconsin in the woods, where they had a wood-burning fire. Now, the text doesn't tell us exactly this directly, but I think this is what John is trying to hint at, is Peter standing around that coal fire, and I think just knowing science and human behavior, for the rest of his life, every time he smells that smell of a coal fire, he would go, oh, I blew it. So in John 21... see, there's only two times in the entire Bible that that word anthrakia is used. In John 21, Peter is on the runs to the shore to see Jesus. And Jesus is on the shore, and he's cooking. And he's got an anthrakia. And he says, Peter, come over here by the fire. Do you love me? And Peter says, you know I love you. You know I do. End of conversation. And Jesus says, no, no, no. Do you love me? Lord, you know I do. I feed my sheep, but Peter, do you love me? At that point, Peter's like, oh my God, what do you want out of me? How many times do I have to say this? Why is Jesus doing that? To make him feel bad? It's the exact opposite. This is true forgiveness. You denied me 3 times. How many times am I going to have to ask you until it's set in your mind? Yeah, you denied me 3 times. Now I'm going to have you affirm me 3 times. And I'm going to have you do it around this coal fire. So the next time you smell this coal fire, you won't hang your head. You will go, he knows I love him. I am forgiven. That's a picture of grace and forgiveness in God's family. It's simple to be the family. It's not about just doctrines. It's not about just a personal, private connection with God. That's important to have your relationship with God. But what God wants of us is to love one another, is to be committed to one another. In 4:19, and I end with this. In 4:19, he says, if you claim to love me, but you hate your brother and sister, and by hate, he means anything other than love, then you're a liar. And he says basically this. Do we have a mom right here somewhere, like a mom that just loves their kids? Like, right here. Everybody's pointing at you. Okay. Do you have a kid who's here? No. Okay, but imagine if I said, I love you, man, we are so tight, and then I walked over every chance I got and I just kicked your kid. I used that example in Harare a couple days ago, and the mom actually said, I would kill you. And I believe it. But the point is this, you can't tell a parent that you love them and hate their kids. And on the road to Damascus, when Paul is persecuting the church, Jesus comes to him and says, Paul, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? And in Matthew 25, Jesus says, whatever you do to the least of these, my brothers, you do to me. And whatever you don't do, you do to me. And God's message, and I totally end with this, is how you treat the family is how you treat God. You want to know how much you love God? Look at how much you love the family. You want to know how committed you are to God? Look how committed you are to the family. That's God's message for his family. Thank you. Amen.